This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year began with women's marches across the country in response to Donald Trump's inauguration. They occurred again last weekend. 2017 ended with the exploding Me Too movement, which shows no signs of letting up and has been augmented by a campaign called Time's Up. These and other protests and movements can begin spontaneously or organically, but to have lasting impact, community organizing seems to be a requirement and a difficult one at that, because organizers have to work on building critical mass for a movement while balancing the ambitions of various aspects of that movement and keeping the big picture in mind all at the same time. There must be both an art and a science to that, just as there is an art in crafting a message that resonates with the progenitors of the movement while attracting new members. But we've invited several people to talk about that and to shed light on keeping movements alive after they experience their initial blush of success. There's also the challenge of how organizers approach the task of disturbing the status quo without alienating many of the people who will need to help if a movement is to succeed. Jan Anderson returns. She is president and coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March. You joined us last week in advance of the march. You're back after a successful march this weekend. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a wonderful weekend.
Well, we'll talk about that. Braxton Winston is now a Charlotte City Councilman who came to most of the city's attention for his participation in the protests that followed the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. He acted as a kind of conscience of the community, which propelled him, I think it's fair to say, propelled you into politics. Would that be fair?
Yes, it definitely kind of put me on the path to where we are and where we're going right now.
Rabbi Judy Schindler is a professor of Jewish studies and the director of the Stan Greenspan Center for Peace and Social Justice at Queen's University of Charlotte. She writes for the Charlotte Observer, and she's also the author of Recharging Judaism, How Civic Engagement is Good for Synagogues, Jews, and America. Welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here.
Good to see you. All three of those folks are in our Spirit Square studio, and with us by phone is Farrah Stockman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times, where she covers social issues like race, protests, and presidential politics. Thank you for being here, Farrah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us live on Facebook Live this morning. Jan, before we talk about organizing and how organizers turn events into sustainable movements, give me your thoughts on this past weekend's Women's March here in Charlotte.
Well, it expected our expectations, and exceeded our expectations, and we were the ones that organized it. We had probably 10,000 people show up, and they came early and spent 2 hours listening to speakers before we marched at noon. So I was just amazed and overwhelmed and so pleased to have that much support still out there.
How does that compare to last year's turnout?
I think last year was probably greater, but it's hard to judge because we had a slightly different format this time. Mm-hmm. So it went very smoothly because we actually had time to plan it this year.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. That's what the whole show's about, actually. This march that happened last year was kind of a very quick, spontaneous, organic thing that happened all across the country. One march led to another, to another, to another, so that we have the massive protest that ended up being the largest protest of its kind in the history of the country. Your group, in Charlotte at least, has been working throughout this past year to keep this thing going, to keep the ideals and the goals and the energy running rampant. What did you do between the march last year and the march this year to make that happen?
Organize, organize, organize.
What does that mean?
Well, let me give you a comparison. There are actually two groups that participated in organizing the march this year. There was one group of four women who had been organizers of the Charlotte March last year, and they called themselves the Women's March on Charlotte. My group happened to be a bus that went to D.C. of women who were mostly older women, 50s and 60s, who had had successful careers, were either retired or established in their careers. And on the way back, we formed the Charlotte Women's March. Now, the first thing we did when we got to town was try to contact the local group and coordinate the two groups together, because the women on my bus were doers, and we knew that we weren't just out to march. The group that was here in Charlotte organized the march, and then that was all they did. Mm-hmm. So we found them again this year, and they rejoined us, And I think we've convinced them now to become part of our group because we do things, you know, 12, 24 all the time. This is not something that's a one day a year kind of event.
So you're approaching it different. And this is one of the things we're going to talk about in this program, because these movements are made up of individuals and not just massive monolithic groups. And there has to be a unifying goal and a unifying message. And the question, I suppose, is how do you galvanize a large group of people over a long period of time, for a long enough period of time, for success to be achieved? Where does that message come from? Who crafts or creates it? And how do you get buy-in from people? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. We can start with you, Jan, but then I want to move on to other people. But how do you do that? How did you do it?
Well, first of all, maybe one of the things that will happen, that will evolve, but in the beginning, we are trying to be all things to all people. So we formed 8 interest groups with co-chairs of each group that are almost independent units within our overall group. Our theme is basically as a networking group. We felt like there were a lot of organizations out there that were single-issue organizations that address things that are of interest to women, like Planned Parenthood or National Organization of Women or League of Women Voters. But our group was the kind that what we're trying to do is mobilize people who would not normally be part of one of these other groups, but will support those groups at times.
Braxton, you came to the protest in downtown Charlotte kind of on your way home from work.
Literally.
You felt literally moved to be part of this and became, through no planning of your own, kind of the meme for this, given the photograph that appeared in the paper, and that propelled you into your career, but into your political career. What is the message? There was obviously anger and frustration in that group of people, and they wanted change. They wanted something to be done. It's not an outgrowth of or even a branch of the Black Lives Matter movement, but they do have intersecting interests. So what's the message? Who crafts the message? How do you keep that kind of that message going?
Well, as Jan said, when you look at the group of people, it's not a monolith. Everybody was out there really for different reasons. I found myself out there on my way home from work, as you said, but then I just started listening to the community that was gathering and was speaking and were asking questions. And I saw how the conversation was going, and I wasn't happy with the responses. I felt like the people had legitimate gripes. So I knew I had a way that I can continue to speak truth that would communicate with one side and connect with the other side. So that's what I started doing. And I felt like I had a duty to do that if I was going to be out there, not to just be an observer, but to be a participant. And really, that's what I've just tried to do since, is speak the truth that I see it. And other people have, I think, found a comfort level in doing that as well around me. So that's why it's been important just to keep showing up to places, keep showing up to conversations and bringing my truth as I see it and my experience and speaking to that. I can't speak to anybody else's.
Do you think, because you're probably going to carry some of these thoughts, I would think, into city council meetings, and you've already made some changes at city council based on access and things like that, do you think that you can be more effective from inside the system than you would have been had you not run and you just continue to be part of an occasional protest or an occasional march or whatever course these things would take?
Yeah, so after the kind of kinetic demonstrations, as I like to refer to them, for the 6 days that I participated in September, some people were out there much longer in terms of, you know, showing up at the police headquarters. But after I was arrested, and I had to really reevaluate how could I be effective? And I saw that there were kind of 3 legs to that. I had to keep showing up as a citizen journalist, so disseminate facts so other people can determine their truth as they saw it and they could act on that in their own right. I had created a platform where I was able to amplify the voices of others. So I had a duty to do that. If certain people came to me in different parts of the community, whether it's the immigrant community, the LGBTQ community, women, just youth, that I would use my platform to amplify their voices, and and has gone to this political aspect, that I do believe that we are a culture of laws and policies. So affect change, you have to do that in the halls of government. So I look to push other people forward, but it's kind of grown to where we are today.
So, Farah, you cover protests in general for the Times, and I know you wrote about some of the marches that took place last weekend on the one-year anniversary of those that followed Donald Trump's inauguration. And you pointed out that despite the unparalleled success of those first marches, which constituted the largest protest of its kind in American history, rifts are beginning to appear as priorities differ and tactics change and as the women's movement has gained power through other means. Is this illustrative of the challenge of keeping movements going, that it becomes rather like taming a tiger?
Well, I mean, I want to point out that rifts and factions are always present in any important social movement. If you look at the civil rights movement, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King did not agree on the tactics. They might not have even agreed on the goals. So you know, just because the leaders don't always agree on the best way forward doesn't mean you can't have a very, robust, movement. So I think that the success of the Women's March last year came from the fact that it was so decentralized. So you had, more than 600 women's marches. There wasn't just one women's march. There were more than 600 all over the country, and women like Ann Anderson and her friends or her acquaintances motivated, and they put on a march, and they left. After the march, they had email addresses. They had phone trees. They had an infrastructure to be able to mobilize people. And they also had the people who left the march and said, I'm an activist now. They started, you know, people who went to these marches started to think of themselves differently. They thought of themselves as activists. They started, you know, thinking of themselves as people who could make change. And so I think, you know, in one way, it's the strength of the movement that was so decentralized and that there were so many people who organized either buses from their local communities to D.C. or marches in their own cities.
But a protest.
But I do think.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Can you finish your thought?
Well, I was just going to say, I do think that there's been an attempt to centralize it by the folks who put on the Women's March in Washington, D.C., an attempt to kind of guide this movement. And I think that's where you do see some friction. You see, you know, hurt egos or differences of priority. And that's very, very real. And it could be dangerous. But I also think it's just reality. It's the way that movements work.
So I hesitate to ask this question, given the amount of time we have left in this segment, which is about 35 seconds. Judy Schindler, we haven't heard from you yet. And I know one of the things that I want to talk to you about as we go through this program is what constitutes a movement. Because a march is a march. A protest is a protest. When does a march, when does a protest officially become a movement, and how does that happen? But you only have 20 seconds, so I'm going to save that question for the next segment. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Judy Schindler is here from Queens University, along with Braxton Winston from City Council, Jan Anderson, the president and coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March, and Farah Stockman, reporter for The New York Times. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet, presenting innovative works, three new ballets made in Charlotte. Reception follows the show January 26th through February 17th. Tickets at charlotteballet.org. And Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at duke-energy.com/future. The January of 45 years ago was a pivotal moment in American politics, one that set the stage for our current political climate. I'll do the math for you. January 1973, that month saw the beginning of Richard Nixon's ill-fated second term, the start of the Watergate burglars trial, the death of Harry Truman, the death of Lyndon Johnson. That month also ushered in the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. And historian James Robinault will talk more about that momentous month and its impact on our world today, tomorrow, on this program at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump slaps tariffs on imported washing machines and solar panels. And that's just for starters. We'll look at the risk and reality of his America First trade policy. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFAG. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with four people who know about protests and movements. Farrah Stockman from the New York Times, who writes about this. Judy Schindler, professor of Jewish studies at Queen's University of Charlotte and the director of the Stan Greenspan Center for Peace and Social Justice there. Braxton Winston, member of Charlotte City Council, and Jan Anderson, president coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March. I was going to ask you how you go from march and movement or march and protest to movement. At what point does a march become a movement? Does a protest become a movement, Judy?
Well, we look at the civil rights movement and we look at the marriage equality movement. And I just wanted to say one word about the question you asked before. How can you bring these fractious groups together? And that is really what creates a movement. Peter Levine of Tufts University says successful political movements were led by sets of fractious and competing organizations that collectively represented the whole field. And that's what we're seeing with the women's movement. To be honest, I wrote an editorial last week. Mm-hmm. My first draft said I'm questioning whether we've achieved that women's movement at this point. And I wasn't settled with it, and I was being challenged by that fact. And so I asked the question, is it a sustainable movement, and what do we need to do to make it a sustainable movement? I think it is on the road to being a sustainable movement. There are many groups working towards this greater goal of women's equality.
One of my frustrations in my experiences the past 18 months is really been this necessity for folks to categorize something, to really explain it. When we were out in the street last September, people kept asking, "Well, what do you want? What is the purpose? What is the thesis?" And I mean, to me, that was one of the least important things. This was a gathering of people that had never been done before here in the city of Charlotte to express themselves in a way that was unlike what we had ever done. When I went up to the inauguration in D.C. and the women's march. There was protests. You know, there was fellowship. There was prayer. I mean, there were people selling T-shirts and exploring the opportunities in capitalism there as well. So, I mean, sometimes you just have to, we always want to kind of put this historic, clean pathway on things when I don't think that's always what it needs to be.
But Braxton, I met you at the marches,
yes.
Right? We created a relationship from which we move forward to create change.
Yes.
It is out of that relationship that you understand my concerns as a woman and I understand your concerns as an African American, and we can work together to create a better community and country. But we need to – it is powerful. Being on the streets is critical. To understand people's issues and concerns and marching with others, that is a first step, right? But we need to move that forward to create the change that we want to see.
Correct. What I'm getting at is that sometimes you just have to go and be.
Absolutely.
And we'll let the history books kind of determine what actually is it a movement? Is it a march? Is it a revolution? What is it? You know,
and God willing, it will become a movement.
We don't have to worry about that, but it does help to articulate clearly what is going on so that other people can understand what the purpose is. I know one of my sisters has asked me, well, why are you marching? And I just sort of look at her, it's like, where do I start? The reasons. So helping to articulate, in our case, you know, women's rights are human rights.
Yeah.
It's not just about women. It's about everyone, but it focuses on women's issues.
Mm-hmm. But I think that if you want to achieve what the people on the streets set out to achieve, whether it's a recognition of wrongs that need to be righted, or whether it's that's what it's all about when you come right down to it, wrongs that need to be righted. That this needs to be coordinated. It needs to have some thrust forward. That needs to continue until the wrongs are righted. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I'm just curious, Farrah, about, like, we had the Tea Party movement. They have been very successful in changing Congress, for one. That's why we have all this gridlock, because we have people who were elected to Congress to do one thing and one thing only, and by God, they're going to do it. And then you have the Wall Street movement. What was it called? The Occupy movement. It just kind of faded away, and they came about, they were birthed at approximately the same time. What was the difference there?
Well, I think I won't say that Occupy faded away. I think some of the leaders of Occupy are now resurfacing in Black Lives Matter. They're resurfacing in the Women's March. So I won't say these people just went away. There's a lot of Antifa and the people who are out there, you know, protesting at the inauguration. Many of them were former Occupy. So they may come back in a different form. But I take your point that some movements seem to make gains much more quickly. And I think Tea Party used the system that was there. They decided to go to town hall meetings and get people elected. And they are, you know, they used what was already the infrastructure that was already there to take over. And I think that Occupy had a different philosophy. They didn't believe in hierarchy. They didn't believe in government. They didn't believe in the Democratic Party. And so all they could do was disrupt the system that was there. They had a much harder time building something new. That takes a lot longer. And so I think the Women's March also is having these debates. Do you use politics? Do you use the Democratic Party? Do you get women elected? Do you back candidates that share your values or not? And some people, I think, inside the leadership of the Women's March said, you know, I don't want us to be hijacked by the Democratic Party. We're something different. But, you know, as you saw with Power to the Polls and other anniversary events that took place this past weekend, they're turning to politics, and women are running for office, and you will see a groundswell of women winning elections. And I think, you know, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, when people look back, they might say, well, look, this is where you saw this huge jump in women serving in Congress or women becoming governors.
Is this how this has to get done? I mean, if for change to happen in a democracy or a republic like ours, is this how it has to happen? Does it happen only with candidates running for office and political parties putting things on their platforms, or does it have to be people in the streets?
Well, I'm going to answer your question with asking a question. When did the American Revolution end?
I think it's probably ongoing.
Exactly. We exist in a protest. We exist in a movement of self-governance, a great experiment in potentially what we could become, not what we were or what we are. This idea that we're continuing to figure it out, that this will never fit in some type of specific beginning and end. So you can't really, you know, okay, neatly tied up in a bow.
Okay. I'd like to add to say something about this. And the word that I want to use is focus. I think there's a benefit to protest, but it helps to have a focus to the protest. It doesn't have to be one focus. Just as Martin Luther King Jr. focused the civil rights movement so that we got some change that was very tangible out of that. He wasn't the only one with issues that were brought up. So it helps to have focus. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement was just about chaos. And we know what happens with chaos. We're looking at it in the government right now. That doesn't work real well. But having a set of goals and a focus, even if it's not every issue, helps. And that's what we're all about with the Charlotte Women's March, is finding a focus for people to exert their energy.
Spoken like an engineer, which you are.
I also want to add that it's not either or. I think you have to elect, you have to have the right to vote and elect people to represent you, but you also have to hold them accountable to the ideas that you want them to hold.
Judy.
And if you look at Black Lives Matter, all these years after we've had Black people elected to office, you still need to hold folks accountable for what you are experiencing on the ground. And so I'm not sure that it's an either or. I think there is a role for both. And I think Occupy, although they didn't get people elected and they sort of faded away, we talk about inequality today a lot more than we did before. We talk about the 1%. This has become a part of Bernie Sanders' rhetoric that he used in his campaign. And he really, I think that's one of the reasons he became such a big candidate to the folks who had believed in Occupy. So some of these things don't just fade away. They morph into something different.
Judy Schindler.
All right. It's not just in the political realm, right? And if you look at the strides we've made from last year's march to this year's march, yes, we do have more women running for office. We just celebrated 15 women in Charlotte-Mecklenburg newly elected to office. We have hundreds more who've already chosen to join the ranks of candidates, and Emily's list reports tens of thousands of inquiries. But the strides we've really made, the Me Too movement, right, holding accountable powerful men in Hollywood, the media, government, and most recently in professional sports, we had 100 women gymnasts testify in a case that their Olympic, their Olympic team doctor assaulted them. We have power. We have the Time's Up movement, and we need to recognize our many sources of power, from purchasing. Right, if companies are not paying women fairly, we need to boycott those companies. We have
everybody.
Power. Right, in hiring, in voting, in philanthropy, we need to use all of our sources of power.
A couple of observations here I'd like to get people's opinions on. The civil rights movement seemed, by today's standards, to move at glacial speed. It did achieve certain goals, ultimately, and people paid heavy prices to achieve those goals. The women's movement, women seem to have gotten it. Women seem to be on the right track here. I mean, they're making strides in every, as you mentioned, just those three different things: the March on Washington following Donald Trump's inauguration, the Me Too movement, the women testifying against this doctor coming forward, which I guess could be part of the Me Too movement. But they really seem to have grabbed the tiger by the tail. Black Lives Matter, not so much, not as successful yet. Why?
I don't know what you mean by successful and unsuccessful. I mean,
we have been
fighting for the equal protections of rights under the law for all people. I know as a black man, that has been the history of my ancestry. When we talk about Martin Luther King, I think his movement gets sanitized, that it wasn't really celebrated like it was as we do now during his time.
Correct.
And as it tried to kind of transition towards just narrowly about black issues and was about to spread towards the whole poverty issue, he was killed. And same thing when you look at Malcolm X, when he started broadening his spectrum, and not just towards the urban black experience, but when he started speaking to Muslims of all races and creeds and color, from all over the world, he was erased. Like, these are things that, again, happen in a continuum. There have been we've been given amazing attention to what has happened in the past year. But I mean, to say that Black Lives Matter this didn't just start in Ferguson, and it doesn't just end with an election, or it doesn't just end with. This is it's perpetual motion here.
Mm-hmm.
And it does a disservice to try to rank and grade it as things go on, because that's just not the reality of.
So how do we measure progress? How do you know you've achieved what you've set out to achieve? What can you learn from the women's movement, which has obviously lit a fire under people, to apply them to your goals? In a different
Well, again, fashion. With the women's movement, we still have more work to do to make it more inclusive. You know, there are people that feel left out here. But that's on both sides. Like I said, when I was there, I didn't feel, as a black man, I felt embraced. I didn't feel pushed away. So we have to continue to find ways to bridge the gaps that really do exist. We really do feel them really strongly here in Charlotte. But it exists in North Carolina, the rest of the country and around the world, to get people to get comfortable, to continue to show up and be able to speak their truths.
And I think that's something that we've been trying to work on. The question that I've gotten most often is the women's movement a white women's movement? And frankly, most of the people on my bus were white, well-educated, women with good jobs. So we were coming from an entitlement perspective. One of our underlying goals for the coming year is diversity and inclusiveness. We started with a reception that we co-hosted with the Black Women's Caucus in December for elected women. And if you look at the roster of speakers that we had for the Women's March on Saturday, it was about as diverse and inclusive a group of women. We didn't have any men, but it was...
Is that by design?
Yes, that was by design. It was intentional that we went that way. And I'm already getting phone calls from other groups that want to join with us in programs.
Farah, as you've looked at these movements and protests across the country, is there anything that you've found, a unifying theme, a unifying way of doing business that seems to be identified with the more successful movements or marches or protests?
Well, I was going to say that I think what's so extraordinary about the women's movement at this moment and the women's march movement at this moment is that it isn't separate from Black Lives Matter. It isn't separate from the fight for the undocumented. Their idea was to embrace all of these identities, to talk about undocumented status, to talk about Islamophobia, to talk about racial justice. Alicia Garza, who's one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, to the extent that it has national leaders, she was speaking in Las Vegas this weekend. So I think, you know, we should recognize that in the past, the women's movement, you know, Betty Friedan and all of the leaders that we think of, Susan B. Anthony, there was a history in the past of excluding Black women from the women's movement, or talking only about, let's say, the right to work, the right to go have a job that was not a secretary. Well, those, you know, Black women have worked all their lives. they were working as maids. They wanted the right to sit down. So, I think that this women's movement right now has been grappling very seriously and very intentionally with the idea of racial privilege inside the women's movement, and they are trying to make it inclusive of women of color, poor women. And I think that part, that's a huge strength, but it's also a weakness. It's also in that it's hard, right? You've got women in Kentucky who are coal miners. They have very different interests than women in California. All around the country, women are facing different kinds of challenges. And so it does make it difficult to have one, to speak with one voice on everything, because women have such different interests, such different socioeconomic statuses, immigration statuses. So that's, I think, why we should expect to see debates over priorities.
This is all about whether it's the women's movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, what happened here locally in Charlotte with regard to the Keith Lamont Scott shooting. This is the Occupy Wall Street movement, in some degrees, I suppose, the Tea Party movement. It's all about social justice. And social justice in the United States of America seems to be a no-brainer. That's what the country is supposed to be about. And yet, when we see these movements crop up, it's because we haven't achieved it, and people get upset when we try to achieve it. So let's come back and talk about that, Judy Schindler, to talk about why we seem to be put roadblocks up against social justice. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Keffer Genesis, introducing a new line of luxury vehicles, sedans with advanced technology, Napa leather interiors, and a selection of V6 and V8 engines. Keffer Genesis, rediscovering luxury. Test drives and details available at keffergenesis.com. And Carolina Pain Associates, committed to non-interventional pain management, utilizing a comprehensive approach to the evaluation and treatment of chronic pain. carolinapainassociates.com. Coming up in 20 minutes, it's On Point with guest host Jane Clayson. President Trump slaps tariffs on imported washing machines and solar panels. That's just for starters. A panel of experts will take a look at the risk and the reality of the president's America First trade policy. Coming up at 10 o'clock, just moments from now, on WFAE. And we will continue our conversation about movements and what constitutes one and how you keep them going in a moment.
Whether you're reflecting back on 2017 or looking ahead into the new year, big stories They're everywhere.
The standard deduction nearly doubled.
Kim warned the U.S. that its mainland is within
allegations of sexual harassment.
So when you just need to get caught up or you want to dig deep, count on Morning Edition for the latest updates with the background that puts it all in perspective for you. Listen every day.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about movements and protests and marches, how they all come together, how you sustain a movement with Jan Anderson, President and Coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March, Braxton Winston, Charlotte City Council, Farrah Stockman, reporter for the New York Times, and Judy Schindler, Professor of Jewish Studies and the Director of the Stan Greenspan Center for Peace and Social Justice at Queen's University of Charlotte. We're all talking about social justice and in a country that purports to be where all men are created equal, et cetera. Why do we seem to put up roadblocks toward things that, when we look back on them, were just social justice issues, being fair?
I think it all goes back to privilege. A professor at Stony Brook University, I think his name is Michael Kimmel, he said, privilege is invisible if you have it, right? You don't recognize what privilege is. If you're white, you don't recognize white privilege, right? If you're male, you might not recognize what it means to be a woman and the struggle you have. And so why do we have roadblocks? Because those with privilege have written history, they've written laws, they have the power. And so in order to gain the power for those who do not have privilege, they have to really organize.
But in instances where there has been success, the civil rights movement, for one, with the Voting Rights Act, et cetera, have there been losses? Have people lost because somebody else won?
That is the fear. They don't see – people don't see it that your gain is my loss, and it's not a zero-sum game, right? We all gain when we create a place in which, you know, all of us are whole and all of us are physically and psychologically safe and have the basics we need – food to eat, a home – a shelter in which to live, and an education. We will thrive as a country when we all have those basics.
Why is that so hard for us to understand? If we really believe the Declaration of Independence and we really believe the Founding Fathers when they wrote the Constitution, why is that so hard?
People are scared about what they're going to have to give up in order for other people to have the basics that they need. I think that's number one. And number two, I think people have fear of the unknown, the other, that person which they do not know. That's actually the power of going out there during the uprising or during the Women's March, is that when you walk with other people, you build relationships. And that in and of itself creates a stronger community.
So the heart – go ahead.
I was going to say my experience in the working world was it's not even so much fear. It's almost like they're – unaware of the difference, so that you tend to hire people who are like you. The guys wanted to hire people that they could talk sports with. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the women aren't as interested in that, but you can do it if you intentionally work towards it. The office that I ran had, I was thinking, I hired an immigrant, two black women engineers. Do you know how hard that is? Not very, if you look at them, if you look for them. You know, another woman engineer and a couple of white men. Mm-hmm. People, good people are out there as long as you look at them for their qualifications and not just to sit around and hang around with them after work.
The Harvard Business Review. Go ahead, Farrah.
I just want to say that I want to inject a little bit of there are people who have lost. Even if you lose something that you shouldn't have had in the first place, it's still a loss. So if you look at the income of white men who've never gone past high school, not very educated white men, their income has stagnated. Okay, they have not gained over the last 30 years. And you can talk to some of these guys. Their industries have gone overseas. Their factories have gone overseas. They're now living off their wife's job, right, when they used to think of themselves as the breadwinner. And they used to work at a factory where they could get their kids hired. They could get their son hired because it was the kind of factory where you had to know someone to get in, right?
And that's where I think you get into the whole dismantling of white supremacy, that the white male was the one that was given equal protections under the law for all people at the beginning. And that created certain situations like what you just described. And then if you start to bring that equality, that you don't have that all of a sudden, you don't have that patriarchy at the top, and you start to dismantle that bit by bit by bit. And whether that's a loss or a gain, I think what you, if you really take a step back and look at it, that's a gain for all people.
I'm not arguing with the premise, with the philosophical premise, but I think that we're kidding ourselves when we say that everyone over that the arc of history is bending towards justice, in that every single person is seeing an economic and even social benefit in their own lives. There are a lot of people who are financially struggling. Well, and they didn't. You used to be able to graduate high school and raise a family, a middle class family, on a factory job.
Okay, so that explains a lot of the anger in the country that led to the election of Donald Trump. But how much of social justice, Judy, is tied to economics? Isn't it just getting people a seat at the table?
Well, I think that's how we make strides, when we lay out not only the moral argument, but the economic argument. The economic argument to providing everyone with housing, right? There are costs to homelessness, right? Not only the moral and religious costs of feeling like I have a home and other people are freezing on the streets, but and our obligation to make sure people have that house. But when we built more place, right, we realized that there were chronically homeless, and the cost of supporting them on the streets was greater than building houses with supportive services to provide for them. So we have to really think through the economic arguments and move towards those sound solutions that work economically. And that's where we really need to find common ground.
So let me share with you some comments that have come in while we've been talking, from listeners on Facebook, et cetera, social media. Deb in Fourth Ward says, "We laughed at the march, the women's march, when we saw vendors selling hats, flags, and buttons, and actually said, you know you've started a movement when the vendors recognize you." Kate on Facebook, "It's great that women of color are being lifted up now in this fight. There is still more work to do, but they have proven many times that all we need to take a seat and listen to what they have to say, that we all need to take a seat and listen to what they have to say." Tanya on Facebook, "When the work is messy, it makes folks uncomfortable. We don't always have to label the action, but we must be clear about the purpose." And these protests are messy. They just are. Anne emails, "Mike, to your point on why Black Lives Matter movement hasn't taken more traction, white people haven't taken up the banner of Black Lives Matter quite like they have flocked to the women's march." And that was my point in asking that question. Why? She's asking the same question. Why?
Comfort. Mm-hmm. It's comfortable. It's uncomfortable to
Why is it comfortable for white males in power to join and support the women's march?
Because they have women, white women in their homes. We've penetrated the bedroom. We're all around them. We're their children, their mothers, their sisters. So it makes it much easier to transcend that barrier.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like I always said with work. You know, they would let the women in the boardroom. Maybe they'd ask her to pour the coffee, but at least she was in the room. Black people probably weren't even in the room.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we experienced last September. Man, it was very uncomfortable out there. We may have some uncomfortable conversations, whether it was white, black, men, women, straight, gay, trans. I mean, we had some very uncomfortable, and we continue, and not everybody was willing to participate within this city, but as we've been perpetuating that conversation, we haven't let things go to bed. It has continued to shape the conversation.
Fiona on Facebook, "I'd like Braxton and the other panelists to speak to something. It's not just about people running or serving in office. It's also about keeping up pressure and support on people in office as policy gets made. What can citizens do when it's not election campaign season?"
Show up. I need you to come to city council chambers and not only tell me what's wrong, but demand things from me and my colleagues.
And our group is starting a phone-in campaign tomorrow for the DACA Dreamers Act,
right,
in Washington. We'll be calling and calling and calling to make sure that our legislatures recognize that if they don't vote for it now, we'll remember it on Election Day.
And thanks in large part to you and your efforts, Braxton. Evidently, they're turning the cameras back on for the citizen comment meetings that the council turned the cameras off for last year.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think democracy works better when there are more people involved, when we have a bigger table and we're serving more folks. So that's been my intention since I started doing this last year. But, you know, really since I was installed, I wanted to learn how to run a city, but also how to get more people engaged so that they can, like I said, come and demand that we do things, because that's what a representative government is supposed to
do. But then people look at what happened during the Moral Monday protests in Raleigh that went on for almost a year, maybe a little longer than a year, and they wonder, did they accomplish anything? Did they?
Yes.
Were their voices heard?
There are voices being heard. Again, this isn't a continuum.
They had to have been heard, because they were there every Monday and they were loud and they were carried out of the legislature building. But, I mean, did anything result from that? Did the legislature change policy, change tactics, think twice about doing things that they might have done without those protests?
You have an amazing – when you talk about movements, you got an amazing movement that's growing out of Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign. I mean, they're literally moving all over this country, doing direct actions, continuing to gather the base and grow. So, I mean, it was a model that, you know, that is inspiring people all over the country, really.
It's part of the problem here that we are an instant gratification country,
yes.
Judy, and we expect things to be done in 28 minutes because that's how it's done on television. And these movements move slowly. They have to gain critical mass. People have to buy in. The message has to be really carefully crafted. Use the right words. People like the word protest. They like the word movement. Things like that have to happen.
I was there at the Moral Monday marches, as were you, Braxton. Were you at those?
I never got up to Raleigh.
So Dr. Barber is now in Washington organizing, taking the Moral Monday movement to the next level with the Poor People's Campaign. I think we start with listening, right? We take our organization, our neighborhood group, whatever group we're a part of, and we listen and we find the cause we want to work on, whether it is women's equality, Black Lives Matter. We have to then look at the big issue and pick one small piece of the puzzle where we can make a significant difference, whether it's the majority of African in our jails, right? Mm-hmm. It's poor individuals who are African American in our jails, because the bonds, fines, and fees, the whole structure privileges those who have means and can buy into the system, right? So we pick an issue where we can make a difference. We say to the 80 groups out there organizing, we look at who's working on this issue. We come together. We strategize. We have to strategize on a local, state, and national level. We move forward towards our goal. So it takes organizing more than anything, and really achievable goals. We can't do something so vast as women's equality or racial justice. We have to break it down into small, achievable goals.
And emails. Your guest, Jan Anderson, stated that she and her cohorts who went to the D.C. march are doers and did not want to simply march. I'm curious as to what actions they are taking, what specifically they are doing right now, and what, if any, policy or legislative initiatives they are hoping to enact.
Well,
you come
see.
Armed.
We started with an WFAE panel last year. We spoke at the Levine Museum. We marched for science, the Pride Parade, the MLK Parade, and the Women's Rights in Barcelona, one of our members did. We went to movie viewings, 13th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, Democracy for Sale. We co-sponsored a reception with the Black Women's Caucus for women elected to office.
And how has all this moved you forward?
It's, first of all, it's educating and informing us as much as anything this past year. It's making us aware of issues. And then in this coming year, we're going to focus more on power to the polls, making sure that people are registered to vote, getting voters to the polls, and asking our members — we do not endorse candidates — but asking our members to support the member of the official running for office of their choice.
But to Andrew's question, what are you hoping that you will achieve? What policy or legislative goals do you have, any, first of all? And secondly, do you hope to achieve them, and how?
We're focusing on getting people who will support our values elected to office this year.
Two comments. Protest movements with specific and limited legislative initiatives seem to be the most successful. Desegregation, voting rights, repeal, modification of HB 2. Would you agree with that?
We need a clear goal, a policy goal. Right now, a policy goal of mine is to keep our undocumented youth safe and protected and give them a path to citizenship.
He goes on to say, provoking but not alienating is also key. Look at the imagery from the 1963 March on Washington or the Memphis strike in 1968, and the messaging is focused, respectful, and clear, such as, I am a man. You make your point, but you don't make ad hominem attacks against your opposition. And that's one of the things that the Harvard Business Review has listed. They have five steps toward successful movements. Define the change you want to see, shift the spectrum of allies, and figure out who your supporters can be. Identify the pillars of power. Who do you have to go after to get change? Seek to attract but not to outpower. Don't demonize the other side. And build a plan to survive victory. Have either of the causes that any of you have adopted, have a plan? Do you have a plan? What happens if you win?
That's tough. I mean, I wasn't sure we'd be around a year later, so we are evolving into that, and I'm sure that's a discussion that'll be a continuing discussion with us.
Well, I was selected to serve on November 7th, for 2 years, and I have a plan to try to use my position to affect that change wherever I can. So as Rabbi Schindler said, I do have a passion for protecting immigrant communities. How can I do that? I spoke from the dais advocating for the sheriff to get out of the 287G program, because while I don't have direct purview over that, I exist in a system, in a criminal justice system, where CMPD, the people that I do have direct purview over, deliver folks into that system, and it makes it difficult for us to effectively serve those folks. So in order to effectively serve immigrant communities, I need to advocate for policy change that will allow me and my employees to do their job. So again, this is not one you can't tie it up in a bow. It happens in a continuum. When we win, we all win. When we lose, we all lose.
And with that, we have to call it quits. Braxton Winston, Charlotte City Council, Judy Schindler, Professor of Jewish Studies and the Director of the Stan Greenspan Center for Peace and Social Justice at Queen's University of Charlotte, Jan Anderson, President and Coordinator of the Charlotte Women's March, and Farrah Stockman, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. Thank you all for the hour.